Hello, and thanks for joining us today for our monthly legal podcast with Missouri Press Association Hotline Attorney Gene Manicky. This is Dawn Kitchell, Education Director for Missouri Press, and today Gene's guest is Pat Groshong, an attorney and Assistant Vice President Claims at Media Professional Insurance. Pat has been with media professionals for 10 years. Before that, he was in private practice in Kansas City, Missouri. Pat is a 1995 graduate of the UMKC Law School. Each month, Missouri Press is bringing you a new legal podcast on issues important to Missouri's newspapers. If you have further questions about topics covered in these podcasts or any newspaper-related legal questions, Gene is available to give advice to active members of the Missouri Press Association at no charge. At the end of this program, we'll provide contact information for Gene, and you can always find that on our website at www.mopress.com. Gene Manicky has served as the Missouri Press Association legal hotline attorney since 1992. Her firm, the Manicky Law Group, is based in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome, Gene and Pat. Let's get started talking about libel insurance and trends across the country in media litigation.
Thanks, Don. Pat, it's great to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Actually, this is the second time this month you and I have had a chance to be together because we spent quite a bit of time at the seminar that you held in Kansas City just a few weeks ago. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm outgoing chair, of course, of the planning committee for that. It's the Media and the Law Seminar. It's an annual seminar that occurs in Kansas City each April. This year was the 22nd annual such seminar, and it's very exciting. It's a national seminar that focuses on First Amendment and intellectual property issues faced by the news organizations in the entertainment industry. It's nationally attended and internationally attended. We had, I think, an attendee from Uganda this year, which was pretty exciting stuff.
Well, and we actually had two of our own Press Association members there. Doug and Rayma Davis from the Lamar Democrat came, and I had a chance to talk with them at lunch, and they had a great time. They were learning a lot, and we're just really impressed, I think, with the programming. So maybe next year we'll be able to get a few more of our members to attend.
That'd be great. It's going to be a gratuitous plug, but April 23rd, 2010, in Kansas City at the Intercontinental Hotel on the Plaza. And we're still working on the program, but I'm very excited about what we'll have in store for next year.
It'll be great because it always is. Why? One of the things we talked about at the seminar was why Kansas City is a hub of media insurance and related issues. That's kind of unique, isn't it?
It really is, and we get that question all the time. Why is this conference in Kansas City? And what I think a lot of people don't know, oddly enough, if there is such a thing, Kansas City is the libel insurance capital of the world. And there are a couple of reasons why that's the case. The product was actually invented domestically by a Kansas City-based company, Employers Reinsurance, and there are about five insurance companies that do this work in Kansas City, which is more than anywhere else in the country, including my company, Media Professional Insurance.
In fact, that first policy was written for William Allen White, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. He had sent a letter in the 1930s, if I remember, to Employers Reinsurance saying, he was then, of course, the editor of the Emporia Gazette, saying, why is there not a product out there that can handle these sorts of risks? And ERC then proceeded to invent such a product. And, of course, some 30, 40 years later, my company spun off, and that has resulted in a whole bunch of different insurance companies that do this kind of work.
So it's interesting that that's based here in Missouri. Many of our members do have libel insurance policies. I know that, media insurance policies. Can you talk a little about what the general policies usually cover? I assume there's some general characteristics regardless of where your policy comes from.
And that's true. And, of course, this is the interesting part of the program. There's nothing more stimulating than talking about insurance. what these policies are designed to cover are really two primary things. The first is wrongful acts, torts, committed in the content that's carried in the newspaper, the stories, the photographs, what have you.
The advertising.
And the advertising, mm-hmm. Exactly, as well as news-gathering activities. If there's a claim involving a reporter who, say, trespasses to get a photograph, resulting in maybe a privacy claim or a trespass claim, designed to cover that. the sorts of claims that it's designed to deal with are primarily things such as defamation, trademark infringement, copyright, invasion of privacy, and then this whole constellation of news gathering torts. Traditionally, those policies were what's called a name peril policy. In other words, you look at the form and there would be this sort of murderer's row of a list of no-nos like defamation, trademark. And the claim had to be phrased reasonably related to those wrongful acts for there to be coverage. That was frustrating for us. If anyone's ever seen a pro se complaint, which of course is a situation where...
And that's a complaint filed by someone without a lawyer.
Exactly. A complaint filed by someone without a lawyer. They're often, shall we say, inartfully pled. And you may be looking at this thing saying, well, gosh, I know what they want to do, but they didn't phrase it that way. Well, we in the industry have now gone to a new standard, which is an open perils form. So basically, if the claim arises from content carried in the newspaper or news gathering activities, the things I said, and there's no exclusion that applies, it's probably going to be covered. You don't have to fit it in a shoebox of defamation or trademark or what have you for that to apply. And it really is a great new development in the libel insurance universe.
That is really exciting because I do believe that the libel suits I have seen in the last 15 years, more frequently than not, are filed by individuals without attorneys. And they are indeed just the kitchen sink. They'll throw in any kind of claim they can come up with, but it always arises out of something that's published.
It does. But you're right. I mean, these claims that come in are often... often strange. I mean, an offense to God, that sort of thing, which really, while, maybe valid, is not recognized under the law. You'd see, but it even goes beyond that. Claims that are maybe just sort of loosely related to the content, not phrased in a way that would have fit those cubby holes, the specific causes of action, would still at least have some coverage, depending, of course, on the facts. And that I think, really broadens coverage and has been a real benefit to our insureds and the insureds of other carriers who have also adopted this kind of form.
Now, the other thing that you and I talked about the other day was subpoena coverage, because truthfully, I think we have fewer papers that are sued for their print material and more papers that are sued over lawyers looking for access to materials, whether they've been published or whether they haven't been published. Subpoenas arrive fairly regularly in Missouri newspaper offices.
Yeah, no doubt. And we and our competitors, and I want to get this out to your listeners, have an endorsement we call the First Amendment endorsement. And it's designed to respond to those very things. When you get the subpoena from a prosecutor who's trying to get the reporter's notes, trying to find out who a confidential source is, it provides coverage for the defense costs in some form. Some of them are issued with a copay, which means maybe a percentage is paid by the carrier, but either way, there's some coverage there, and sometimes all of it, all of the defense costs, to fight that subpoena. And that's critical. I mean, it doesn't have to be a defamation claim to impact the First Amendment. In many ways, the subpoenas and the state action to try to pry open the reporter's notes is more of a problem for the First Amendment, even. And so it's a very good product. And even if your listeners aren't with us, they should, if they do see these or are fearful of seeing these, should talk to their insurance broker and to their carrier about adding this sort of coverage. Because I do see an awful lot of situations where an insured wasn't aware of that, and it could have been very beneficial. You think back to the New York Times
and a little while ago,
and the Judith Miller saga. Well, and I don't know if they had that coverage, but if they did, it certainly cost millions, I'm guessing, to litigate that situation. And you may want to give some background on that.
Well, that's absolutely true. So many times, ultimately, we prevail one way or another, whether the party seeking the information goes away or we outlast them and eventually they don't need it anymore. But frequently, the attorney's fees are the primary cost you actually incur. It's not like you're looking at a judgment for dollars. It's more your defense costs that
There's
are the problem.
No question about that. And in fact, our experience, and we've got pretty broad catalog of claims in the office right now, is that the vast majority of what's paid out on policies is defense costs, not what we would call indemnity, in other words, paying for a settlement or a judgment. And I should back up for 1 second. And we talked about the type of matter that's covered in these policies and the sorts of claims that are covered. But I think it's important to note that what these policies cover is they pay the defense costs, the attorney's fees to fight the cases. And then, absent a coverage problem, they also pay for any settlement that occurs or a judgment and the court costs that go along with that. In the event it's an adverse judgment for the newspaper or other insured, and then appellate costs as well.
That's good. Several of our newspapers have launched into areas of internet publishing, and they're doing comments to stories. They're allowing readers to comment on stories. Some of them actually have reader-created blogs that they are hosting on their websites to allow interaction with their readers. Can you talk a little bit about how the law is changing in that area? That's something I know a lot of our listeners are going to be interested in.
Sure. I mean, it obviously is not lost on us, as if it could be, in terms of the incredible transformation the newspaper industry is undergoing and the impact of the web on that. And to step back for a moment, I think one truism we've learned over the years is that anytime there is a new development in the technology available to deliver content, the law is often slow to catch up. And even when law is put on the books, it often has to be interpreted. So it's sort of a moving target. There are two large pieces of legislation that are now law that impact the user-generated content universe. And that, as you know, Gene, probably far better than I, is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which deals primarily with defamation, that sort of stuff. And then the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which relates to copywritten material. Again, all of this stuff posted by users. Switching to Section 230, what that provides is a defense, a blanket defense, for the web host or newspaper, if it's a newspaper site, for defamatory content posted by users. And it really is quite a broad defense. Comparing it to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, there is no takedown requirement to have this defense available to you when you're using Section 230 and you're in the defamation context.
So if one of our listeners has comments on their website and they find a defamatory comment has been made, they're not required under federal law to take that comment down.
Correct. But the neat thing about Section 230 is they can, without being considered as exerting editorial control over that content, again,
right,
you know, at risk of taking them out of the CDA. That's not going to happen there. Now, the limitations are developing. I mean, it frankly is a breathtaking defense in terms of the scope. The most recent case is the roommates.com case out of the Ninth Circuit that Judge Kaczynski, a very famous jurist, who, by the way, shameless plug, spoke at our seminar, penned. But what he said is, in that particular case, Roommates.com had constructed the website such that, in his opinion, it, by the way they required users to answer questions, they were at risk to violate the Fair Housing Act. And he said, well, listen, this is different than a typical comment situation. There was a material advancement of this wrongful act, or could have been. And so this defense, the Communications Decency Act, will not apply to you, Roommates.com. So that gives us some instruction. And what your listeners should remember as sort of a lesson from that is, so long as you don't tamper with that content, edit it, or perhaps create a headline that paraphrases what's in there, generally speaking, you should have strong defenses under the CDA. Switching real quick to the DMCA, which probably isn't as relevant as the CDA to what newspapers would do, but maybe more so as newspapers explore new avenues to disseminate content over the web. That is rather different in that in order to avail yourself of the defenses, which are also broad under the DMCA, if you get a notice from a claimant that content posted on the internet infringes their copyright, you're required to take that down.
Right.
You got to take that down. And if you don't, then you're at risk of losing that defense, that blanket defense. And there are other things in play. You've got to have a repeat offender log, that sort of stuff. And really, if you're allowing users to post images, video content, audio content, you need to have those safeguards in place to make sure the DMCA is available, and you need to talk to a lawyer such as Gene Manicky.
Well, I always encourage them to call, because that way at least we can get involved early and help resolve some of the problems that they have.
Absolutely.
There's been a lot of great information in this podcast. Thanks to Pat Groshong, an attorney in the Claims Department at Media Professional Insurance, and Missouri Press Association Legal Hotline attorney Gene Manicky for sharing their expertise with us today. We hope today's show has given you new information about libel insurance and litigation trends across the country. If you'd like more information about Pat's company, you can visit www.mediaprof.com. A valuable benefit of membership in the Missouri Press Association is legal hotline services. Active members may contact Gene directly for advice and answers to legal issues. Gene can be reached by telephone at 816-753-9000 or by email at jmanicky@manickylaw.com. You can find this contact information anytime on the Missouri Press Association website, www.mopress.com. The website also provides links to Gene's blog and current and back issues of the Missouri Press News Magazine, which features a monthly column by Gene. This is Dawn Kitchell, and I hope you'll join us for the next legal podcast from the Missouri Press Association.